All right, welcome back to Return on Podcast, where we talk about the experiences, the obsessions, and habits of the most successful e-commerce entrepreneurs. I'm Tyler Jeffcoat, and I want to welcome you to today's episode. Today, we're going to be talking about liquidity, cash flow, bank management, treasury, some things that you're like, oh my God, why would I listen to a podcast about that? But I want to encourage you to stick with me here. The insights from my friend Jason Garcia, he's the founder, he's the CEO of a company called Holdings.io, where they're trying to solve some of the risk management issues where people were worried about their cash being lost, you know, several months ago when some of the big banks like Silicon Valley Bank were struggling. They've solved that problem. FinTech now allows us to get a high interest rate on idle cash while giving us additional protection should something weird happen in a bank or in a market. So yes, we're going to talk about that a little bit, but more importantly, Jason and I are going to get really tactical about how the current economic environment, how the current interest rate environment should dictate, should inform, should give us better perspective when planning for the next couple of years of our business. So 2024, and in particular winning in the coming year, 2024, is not going to look like it looked in 2008. It's not going to look like it looked in 2018. And it's not going to look like it looked in 2020 during the heat of the pandemic. The strategy, the focus, the precision, I think is the word he uses at one point in this interview, is very different now, and it deserves our attention. So I just want to welcome you now to this episode and hope you enjoy this interview with Jason Garcia from Holdings.io. It's time to maximize profitability and cash flow. It's time to learn habits and hacks from the best e-com CEOs. It's time for Return on Podcast with me, Tyler Jeffcoat. All right, today I have Jason Garcia, CEO of Holdings.io, growing fintech company. Jason, how you doing today, man?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, buddy. It's funny. You and I have been like swimming in the same circles for a couple of years now, and it's good to finally get, you know, a little bit of face time with you here. So listen, bro, you and I are both recovering accountants. I guess I haven't fully recovered because I opened an accounting firm, but like your journey of like various kind of fintech startups, C-suite, you've kind of done some of the like biz dev side of things. You've been a CFO before. And now you find yourself in a position where you've started your own kind of fintech company. Can you give us a bit of a glimpse into like maybe what the aha moment was or what it was that was like, all right, Jason, time to go strike out on your own? Like, how was that experience and that pivot been for you?
Yeah. It's definitely been a journey. So I used to be at a bank for a long, long time. One of the banks that hit headlines this year, Silicon Valley Bank. And helped run their office for a period of time here in the Mountain West. And we did really good work, relationship. They'd have a really good level of service, but the products aren't the best. You wouldn't ask. I would be surprised if any SVB client would say, hey, I work with them because of their software or because of the login and how you send a wire. But for a certain period of time, I didn't think I had control over that. And then I became a CFO, like managing these products in a more hands-on way. And didn't really enjoy that. A lot of those experiences, even just a wire where you've got to get that phone call to like send a wire out. You're a fast moving company. It makes no sense for you to have to call somebody or confirm all that type of stuff. So there came a point where I ended up joining a fintech company specifically to run partnerships. And as a part of that relationship and that kind of employment, I actually had impact to like change the experience. I was like, oh, like not all financial products have to be ugly or clunky or bad. You can actually have an impact. So that's what kind of brought me to this where I'm at now, which is like what we do is we provide yield products to companies. And when you think about yield products for a lot of small companies, the only way you can earn interest on your money is a savings account, which is 0.02%. So you're earning like nothing. Or you put it into a CD. And if you've got a working capital cycle, you can't tie money up for 6 months and say, hey, I'm not going to touch 100 to 500K. Right. And so this was an area where it's like, you know, we're in a raising rate environment. People should get the benefit of that. But most companies don't have the liquidity where they can tie their money up. So, you know, it was like, hey, this is a classic where the experience is bad. You know, we should come in and use software and technology to try to make things easier.
Yeah, like my understanding, because I also worked at a bank for a few years, and I like thinking about your product, I want to dig into it just a little bit here. But like you guys are kind of at the intersection of two problems, and you know, candidly, your timing probably couldn't have been better in terms of you guys launching earlier this year because of the, you know, the Silicon Valley stuff and Signature Bank and everything else. But problem one is what you just described. I don't have 6 months to tie my entire pile of liquidity up to get 3.5% or whatever the interest rate is, but I'm tired of getting nothing for my cash. And then problem two is, wow, it really scared the hell out of all of my friends 9 months ago when we were worried about FDIC insurance and coverage and risk management related to our capital. And so I don't have enough buckets of free cash sitting around to feel like I can solve all of these problems simultaneously. And I hope I'm framing this fairly, but you guys kind of are an attempt to help solve both sides of this problem. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, like when we simplify, what is it that we do? We keep your money safe and growing. You know, you like everyone wants to keep it growing in some way. And all of us personally, right? Like most of us don't keep our money just straight in the checking account. And even the people that are trading on Robinhood, the vast majority of people are putting $50, $100 a month into that. Like it's not like massive amounts, but we're doing anything we can to get an edge. On the business side, you're left to a checking account that earns 0% or a savings account that earns close to 0%. And then on the safety side, you know, the largest of companies in the world, Apple, Google, they all have these complicated treasury structures. Most of the businesses that you and I work with, they don't have 10-person finance teams. They might not have a finance team at all. And the owner who's running the business intuitively understands I should be doing something more with my money, either to keep it safe or growing. But I'm not a CPA. I'm not an MBA. I'm running a business. I don't have the time for that. So like, yeah, that is really what we're kind of going after, which is to try to give you that growth and safety in a way that is really approachable and easy to implement. I mean, even down to our onboarding process, I was talking to one of our clients the other day. They opened a brokerage account with JP Morgan during the bank crisis, and they moved a little bit more money over into one account. They still have like 15 pages of documents they still have to manually fill out. And there's some things that they have to meet in person to go do that type of stuff. And a lot of us just don't have the time to do that. Our onboarding process is a 15-minute digital application, and you do it in the leisure of your own time on your own computer. You upload the documents. You're not going into a branch, none of those types of things. And so, it's a very different, like trying to give you the benefits that you want without experiencing all the bad kind of normal stuff that has just not been innovated on or changed for decades. Mm.
So make this practical a little bit, because we talk about, I want to get your advice on how typical sellers or brand owners might build their kind of, I call it like a fintech stack, right? I mean, like this might be the combination of offerings like holdings.io, yours, and your traditional banks. Like if you were a $1 million brand, you're obviously not sitting on enough cash to need a $3 million FDIC insurance, but you still have some of the challenges that you just articulated. Like if you were sitting in that seat as an executive, how would you kind of build out the banking and fintech stack around that business?
Yeah, it's a good question. And now is actually a really good time to think about this, because we're going Q4. Some of these businesses are going to have the most cash that they've had all year, right?
Right.
Black Friday, holidays. Q1 is when you really kind of want to have this stuff set up. But I think there's if you're a digital brand and your majority of your customers are paying you through Stripe or something like that, go digital across the stack. It's when you have a cross of kind of in-person retail, you're collecting cash or checks or whatever it might be, where you might want to have a branch. But we're at a point now where like mobile deposit's pretty good. Even with more digital kind of products, bill pay and all that type of stuff is pretty easy to kind of set up. Even if you're not, you know, a finance, you know, experienced person. So what I would do is, you've got your normal kind of checking account. I'd try to keep maybe a payroll, one or two in there, just to make sure you always have access to that capital. You don't want to be in a pinch where you got to transfer money to make payroll. And the best you can is to try to manage to that type of cash in that. We actually have in our product, we have an ability to set rules. So you could say, hey, one payroll run, I'm just using a round number, one payroll run's 50K. So, you know, I want to keep 50K in my normal, you know, checking account at all times. I want the rest of it growing. So you can set that rule in our product, and our product will actually create transactions for you and send it to you by email and say, hey, you should transfer this money in order to meet that 50K rule that you had set. So we're trying to even automate the chores around managing two different bank accounts. And so I would use something like that, because then you can actually get the money growing. There's a lot less kind of manual management to it. You don't want to have like a weekly meeting on Friday to go check your cash and make sure it's in the right accounts. So we help automate that type of stuff. And then, you know, unlike I think most other companies, sellers specifically, need a good way of understanding all this data that's happening in there, whether right. that's a triple whale or something else. But, you know, I think having an idea of your cash flow generally, these businesses are just, you know, seller businesses are more complex than some others. And so having a good idea and grasp on your cash flow, inflow, outflow is a lot more critical than I think others. And so that also impacts who do you choose on a banking or cash management side. You want somebody who's going to have some connectivity to other tools so you can kind of get an idea of those types of things. So.
Totally makes sense. So, all right. So just a quick like layman's term question here.
Yeah. Again,
you know, you and I are both accountants. We've both worked in banking. When you think about the anxiety that people felt related to FDIC insurance, and you like try to figure out what this a product like holdings.io do, like, can you just kind of give us the quick rundown of this is why this kind of helps the problem and isn't like a scam or something like it? Can you kind of like unpack yeah. that for us?
Absolutely. If for those out there that don't, you know, don't nerd out on banking things, this may get a little nerdy here, but, so banks in general for decades, they've been using these things called cash sweep networks, which basically means, you know, they take deposits from a bunch of different customers and they have different partners on the back end where they diversify cash to. We are doing basically the same thing, except we're offering it to the end consumer. So when you go to a bank, a small bank, they have to have a certain amount of deposits for the loans that they give. And then they go and build these other relationships. If their deposits get to a point where they need more, they raise their hand and to a big brother bank and they say, hey, I need some deposits to kind of borrow overnight or whatever else it might be. And because that bank is really holding the cash to meet certain standards, but they're not trying to monetize or lend that capital out, they're willing to pay rate to the big brother bank that they borrow from for the cash that they're able to generate through that relationship. We're doing the same thing, which is we're a part of a cash sweep network that has billions of dollars in it. It's been around for decades. So our product that we're offering to end consumers is new to those businesses because they haven't experienced it before. But this is something that's been around for decades and decades. That's what we're doing is we're taking your cash, we're generating, and then we've got 30 different partner banks on the back end. We diversify by taking 250K of, let's say, $1 million. We take four different pieces of that 250K that we get from a $1 million customer. We place it with four different banks. The way FDIC works is it's $250,000 of FDIC insurance per entity, so per company, per institution. So because we're taking that $1 million, cutting it into four, we're able to get that $1 million of FDIC because it's at four different banks. So again, like, you know, this is not a loophole, not a trick at all. This is something that, you know, banks, financial institutions, again, your largest public companies leverage these products to keep their money safe when they're, you know, this is like, hey, I've got $1 million, only 250K is covered. I have 750,000 that's uninsured. I don't trust my bank. This is the product you use. This is the even more conservative than your normal bank type product. And then the added benefit is because we're generating those deposits, we pay 4.82%. So per $1 million, we're paying you $4,000 a month, which, you know, could pay lease, could pay headcount, could pay inventory. It's a new kind of financing model where we're used to making money on reward points in credit cards, but now we're offering sellers an ability to earn money on their own money.
I love it. I mean, what you're articulating there, Jason, it makes so much sense. Really, really well said is The biggest, most sophisticated, you even mentioned earlier, like having 10 people in your finance department, like the most resource rich companies have been employing sophisticated treasury tactics for decades. And what fintech is now allowing us to do, and in particular offerings like yours at holdings.io, Jason, it just makes that benefit accessible to the regular guy, to the guy who doesn't have an $180 million company, may only be a $5 million company or $1 million company, right?
Yeah. And that's like the passion that we have internally is I've worked with a lot of e-commerce brands over my career, and they're some of the best operators because they, you know, you've got all these things to manage and the logistics are really difficult. But I would say vast majority of them are not CPAs or have like really deep finance knowledge, but you need these types of tools and these types of benefits. So to your point, like our passion is to put it in a box that's easy to kind of set up and access. And then you can utilize as a company while you're focusing on your business and everything else that's going on. So
just kind of, again, just trying to, again, like want to be careful guys, not to give you so much like yawn banker stuff that you turn this off here. I'm just kind of interested in this entrepreneurial journey, right? Like looking at your history here, Jason, you obviously have very like entrepreneurial builder spirit, kind of getting back to like the fact that you built a company. I've built a couple of companies. You've been integral in a couple of companies and now you're at the helm. Like what would you say is the core difference in launching a brand the way you're launching it versus launching, you know, a seven-figure accounting firm like mine or a seven-figure Amazon brand? I mean, like what's your understanding of the like founder journey? Like how is it different when you're in fintech?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us in general, brand affiliation is always important. And I think like in consumer brands, it's affiliated with who the consumer is and is it, you know, is it fit me, my lifestyle, and something that's brings utility to me. For us, the brand affiliation is trust, right? And that's where I think it's a little bit different. Like every product to a certain degree has this like, it just needs to work, right? I buy a water bottle and I want it to do some certain thing and I want it to, you know, it just needs to work. I want the shirt. I want it to look a certain way. It just needs to work. Ours, the level of trust that it just needs to work is a lot higher. I'm, you know, on average, our customers hold about $2 million with us. Our average customer holds $2 million with us. That's a sizable amount of money. And for some of the brands that we work with, you know, that's a good portion of their cash that they hold with us. And when you need to send a wire back to a vendor or back to your main bank to send out for an inventory run, it better work. And so I think that the trust factor is a little bit different on the fintech side. You know, that's hard to convey sometimes to, through marketing and those types of things where it is, you know, hey, we work with a real estate development firm that's holding $10 million in cash with us. Like that's a good valid, people want to see that there's people that have tested it, jumped in and those types of things, maybe more than, not necessarily more, but different than, reviews on a certain product.
Yeah, makes sense. No, it really makes sense. Like, yeah, no one wants to be the first one to test the like latest fintech product unless like there's lots of validation. And so, yeah, I completely get that. There are certain business activities, Jason, that the cost of getting it wrong are, you know, higher than other business, you know, just like guy mows my lawn, misses half the lawn. Maybe my wife gives me a hard time, Jason, but at the end of the day, like the guy comes back out, he does a good job. It's fine. You know, you lose $1 million wire transfer that I'm concerned about, and you get the you get that cortisol anxiety response that's on a completely different planet. And yeah. I think you're right, the like market adoption and then the attack plan for the market probably has to be a lot different for that kind of a product.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially on ours, like you know, there are fintech companies you work with where wires do go missing. They go missing for months. It's hard to track it down. I also think like right now, this is especially important to sellers on the financing side. My background is a lender and in some of the best markets where, you know, we were leveraging and accessing financing at like close to 0%. And right now, I think a lot of sellers, unfortunately, are experiencing this right now where, the lender, when you got the loan, the rate might have been different. We've been raising rates for a long time. Cost is going up. Maybe lenders are getting a little bit more risk averse, and so they're asking a lot more of their borrowers and the e-commerce brands they work with. I mean, I don't know if you've been seeing this on your side, but what's been interesting in fintech, we're an oddity in that we focus on deposits. I don't think there's as many there. There was like a big, huge proliferation of lenders over the last couple of years, and a lot of them are not lending anymore. And a lot of it's because it didn't work. Whether they borrowed money at too high a rate and they just can't put it out anymore, or the people that were giving them money are just not, giving them any more money, they're walking away from the deal. So it's been interesting to watch that. And I think that's been really top of mind for companies lately, is how do I access capital at like a reasonable rate from reasonable lenders?
Makes sense. So yeah, and let's get into a little prognostication here, Jason, because obviously you and I have a crystal ball and know the future. But the rate environment has obviously been interesting. It's almost like whether it's good or bad, it's just been changed. It has changed. And obviously, if you have $1 million in deposits, that change is good because you can get a better interest rate on your deposits. If you're trying to borrow money, it's been really hard. My question for you is, as you're so close to the capital markets, that's an advantage for me and my audience, because we get to ask you, like, what are you seeing that should impact our strategy or our thinking or our alert level going into 2024? Is there anything that's kind of on your horizon that you say, okay, this might impact e-commerce, this might impact the Amazon universe and kind of related industries?
Yeah, I mean, one thing is I'm not sure that rates are done rising. I think there was a little bit of a sentiment there over the summer that like, we're done. I think looking at some of the numbers, the inflation numbers, the job numbers, and then now we've got massive geopolitical things that are happening too. We potentially could continue to see some rates rise. So I think that's something to think about if you are thinking about borrowing right now and part of your strategy is renewing a loan or something, is if you're on a floating rate, that pricing is likely gonna go up. I think the other thing too is the largest of companies, when they take a loan, they're able to fix that rate. I'd say the majority of the companies probably listening in that you work with and the majority that we work with, they don't have that advantage. And some of the largest companies will do a hedging strategy, really kind of complicated type notes to try to fix that rate if it's not fully fixed. And again, the companies we work with just don't have that access. So the best thing you can do right now is to try to offset your loan with yield. If you're borrowing at 10-15%, let's say 10%, we provide about 5% in yield. If you're taking that loan and putting it into our account, you're effectively cutting every dollar that's in our account that you've borrowed is cutting down from 10% cost to 5% cost. I think that's about as best as we can do. But as we think about loans right now, I've seen a bunch of brands that have borrowed a lot over the last couple of years. Now they're finding themselves in a really tough cash flow situation. And so in general, if it's a nice to have and it's more than 10%, I would not take it just in this environment, because we don't know where it's going to go. And you get hooked on it, becomes a symbiotic relationship that I don't know that it's great for brands.
Man, that's good advice, just to bring that home, guys. I think I've seen this also with our clients and our CFO practice here, Jason, where if we're funding our operations using, poor sources of debt, and unfortunately, as the core interest rates grow, like more and more sources of debt feel like poor sources now, because, you kind of start doing the math on that cost of capital and you realize, wow, the kind of profitability I've got to be able to achieve to kind of keep up with the house of cards that's being built here is getting harder and harder to manage. And then you combine that with any kind of pressure on our TACOs, total advertising budgets, or any pressure on supply chain logistics charges. And we end up in a situation where we're not going to be negative Nancy's the whole time here, guys, but like I was reading a report recently where there's a record number of what they call zombie businesses right now, where the ability to barely meet the interest obligations of the leverage that's been borrowed for the business, but there's kind of no other traction that can be done, right? These businesses exist but are kind of a shell. And so to your point, Jason, this is why we want to have this discussion now, guys. If interest rates get a little bit worse, next year into Q2, into Q3 of next year. We want you, Jason and I want you, to have a cash position that gives you the ability to survive and be healthy. Yeah. Remember, recessions create wealth transfer. And so, like Jason said, if it's a nice to have, if I was, make this really tactical and I want to get your take on it. Like, if I was going to launch 5 new products and I don't have enough healthy debt to fund all 5, now's the time to make a hard choice and only launch 3 of them so that I can make sure I'm well capitalized enough to handle any waves that might come across my desk over the next 6 to 9 months. And then again, on the flip side, if I'm looking to expand into a different market, say I was in Amazon US and I'm looking to go into the EU, what I don't want to do is I don't want to half-ass the launch of a new marketplace or a new product line. I want to make sure that I'm a little bit more conservative in my capital estimates of what's needed, and that I don't get overextended, because my 3 years ago definition of overextended is now going to be different than what it needs to be now, right? I mean, what are your thoughts on that, Jason?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, something that you said earlier, which was this like margin of error is a lot smaller. So like when we were in a, you know, an easy market to access capital, whether equity or debt, the level of aggression you can have towards growing your business can just be a lot higher. And I like, there are plenty of brands, you and I work with plenty of brands that are growing right now, and you know, they're doing great. I would say though that a lot of them are just being a little more calculated, and it doesn't mean that they're not growing. It just means they're maybe not growing 300% year over year, like they were stacking the leverage on top of it. And that's okay. And also, I think understanding your repeat purchases right now and, you know, how your metrics are performing is important. Because, you know, if you do take on debt, you want to really have a good idea that that money's coming back from customers to pay off that debt. So I still think, like, again, I've been a lender for a lot of my career, believe in debt. And I think leverage is good for all businesses and used the right way. I think that understanding, you just need to have the right understanding. Something that I've always believed too is that financial literacy can be a competitive advantage for founders and companies and operators. And now is a time where that is definitely true. If you understand what the appropriate amount of debt on your business is, how do you leverage credit cards? You know, how do you access yield? Those types of things can give you an edge, and those, you know, in business, it's a game of inches. Every inch it matters. And so if you get those small decisions right, they stack up and can make a big difference.
Yeah, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I'm a big college football fan, Jason. I'm here in Athens, Georgia. My Bulldogs are on top yeah. of the world right now, right? And we think about, like, when Georgia plays a really bad team, we can make lots of errors. We can commit a ton of penalties. You can throw a couple of interceptions and you still win, because you're not winning on the edges or the margins of the competition. As you play, like Georgia plays Ohio State again, like we did last year, or Alabama, a team that's like as elite in terms of talent as we are, winning or losing the game has 100% depends on those marginal at the edges of the business elements that you described there, where you create, you commit a couple of 15-yard penalties, you're dead. You throw an interception, you're dead. And I think when you apply that to business, it's the same thing. And this is why I love what you just said there. It's guys, as things tighten up, it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be lots and lots of winners. It just means that those lots and lots of winners are going to be better at executing along the margins of their business. And they're not going to take anything for granted. They're going to be a little bit sharper when it comes to managing their money. They're going to be a little bit sharper when it comes to managing their supply chains. They're going to be a little bit sharper when they come to managing their marketing efforts. And yeah, do you have any nuggets? So for that, I'm putting myself in the position of somebody listening to this that says, yeah, thanks a lot, Jason. Thanks a lot, Tyler. But I'm that guy you're talking about that wants to get an edge, to be a little bit more financially literate, a little bit more sophisticated. Do you have a couple of nuggets or advice points that someone that wants to dig in and make that a bigger part of their playbook? Like what do they do about it?
I think they, you know, obviously they can reach out to either one of us. I think, you know, folks like you all that are, you know, advising and helping people through that, I think is important. You know, it's in entrepreneurship, even if you're a solo founder, it's still a team sport. And so reaching out and building those advisors and relationships that can help you kind of navigate it, I think is really important, especially right now. And the beauty of it, just maybe hammering on something you said, the beauty of it is, like you said, like right now you can still win. It might be smaller margin of error, but the beauty is that there's a cycle to this thing. And so when the market starts opening up again and you've got that discipline and precision and understanding across your business in the finances or in the working capital cycle, whatever it might be, that margin for error that was smaller as it starts increasing is only a huge advantage for your business. And so it's almost like, you know, using a sports analogy again, in those tough years, you kind of build up that discipline and strength, or in the training, you build up that strength for the, you know, the actual game time where you really can kind of let loose and go fast. Right now may not be your 100% growth year over year. That's okay. Yep. That'll come as you build that kind of discipline and cycles inside of your business. It'll all come around. So, but I think, you know, reaching out, trying to find advisors, mentors that can help you understand the finance side. There's plenty of people that want to help. And then also, you know, read content as much as you possibly can. Unfortunately, there's not, I don't know how you feel, but like outside of podcasts like this, there's not a ton that, you know, us finance people like to talk in jargon that is really confusing for people. It's not approachable. I've got a website, SirJRG, which is my Twitter tag. I've got some articles on there. They're not as active on that as I used to be, but, and then you've got your podcast, but that's what I would try to do. Try to take in your daily kind of understanding of finance, get accustomed to it. You don't need to be an expert, but expose yourself to it. And these are the times to kind of build that discipline and
understanding. Love it. I think it's super well said. And yeah, I hope you guys will do that. I mean, another one I'll think about is, was it Ben Thompson's Stratechery is one of my favorites. Like, if I just want to listen to the smartest guys in the world talk about how the economics of businesses work. And the crazy thing is, you know, Jason's in fintech. I own an accounting shop. You know, you guys own your brands that are selling online. But actually, the core business problems are the same, right? Yeah. How can we manage liquidity? How can we find and develop relationships with customers? And how can we deliver the product or service at a price that allows us to be profitable? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, like, that's what we're doing. Like, the role of every founder is to find profit. And so just to go back to one thing you said a minute ago, Jason, guys, there's never been a more important time to change our mantra to be sales is vanity, profit is sanity, right? So to your point about growing 100% year over year, let's grow 5% or let's be flat, but let's make money. Let's make sure that we have a business that has a core engine that generates positive economic traction. Because there is going to come a time, and this is actually going to be sooner than we think. It's maybe going to be 24 months. It's going to be 36 months. I don't know, where capital markets are going to be much more favorable to the e-com space. There may be another aggregator kind of rush. We don't know, but that's going to be the time as you approach it to put the pedal to the metal and to pay extra, you know, have a higher cost to acquire a customer, have a more explosive strategy. As things are getting a little bit smaller, just be small. It's okay to be smaller. Just be profitably smaller. You know, don't be digging a hole while you're smaller. You know? Yeah. I think that's true for every business model.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's interesting though, as you talk with companies and you think about other advice or resources, what other resources do you guys typically give out to customers to understand these types of topics? Whether it's even just the metrics you help people understand.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm with you. I like trying to find a couple of podcasts that stretch me. I'm a really big fan of trying to find a peer group of guys that are doing what I'm doing, right? If I'm, you know, guys, I lead a peer group of CEOs that are Amazon sellers, but I'm also in a peer group, even of my competitors. Like, I want to know what's happening, because my best source of intelligence for how to not screw up the economics of my business, or how to get better at hiring, or how to get better at marketing, is actually going to the guy who's a really nice guy. He's killing me on the one. His one product's better than mine, and he's beating me in the marketplace. I might be better in this other one. And we just kind of, I just try to create connections and relationships with people who are doing it, even if they're in slightly different industries. And then I try to have an authentic giver's gain. How can I help these guys win and then glean from them? And I think for me, that's probably been the most powerful part of my playbook, is just being don't neglect. Like, a lot of times e-commerce can kind of be this, like, this happens in my basement. Like, I got a cape on, I'm in my basement, I'm like doing this thing, right?
Yeah.
But actually, if you're going to make an adult company out of it, you can't do that. You still have to do the effort to kind of build relationships. And, you know, I mean, listen, we were in a room with a guy like in the fetal position, grown man crying through bankruptcy last year. And we were in the room with a guy that just stroked a $30 million check. And so both in a positive way. And in both instances, having that network of people around you has been key.
I could see that. I mean, also online, you know, not all the advice is good, nor is it accurate either. And, you know, Twitter, especially over the last year or two, it's flooded with a lot of opinions that, you know, may not be the right way to build a business. In fact, I was thinking about this the other day because I was talking to a company and they've got this advisor that made their money through 2020, 2021. And it was actually kind of off of the vanity metrics that you talked about. And that acquirer now doesn't really know what to do with the brand. I think is looking to sell the business because it doesn't quite work. And so the other thing to be careful of right now is that, like, what worked in 2021 and 2022 may not work in 2023 and 2024. And we're seeing that with change of algorithms. And I'm not just talking about the tech side. I'm talking about business, like, you know, cost to acquire a customer, the metrics that, you know, maybe your competitors cared about are maybe not the metrics that you should be driving your business with. So making sure you choose those right advisors, I think, is also really important. Vetting them and understanding, you know, what is it that they really did? If they built a business in a year or two and it grew really, really fast and they sold it, they might not have a real recipe to build a business over again. And so listen to those that have really been battle tested to understand.
That's really great. Yeah. Cause you know what, they could earn, and I would say legitimately earn, the guru status, quote unquote. And yet, to your point, Jason, they may actually not be qualified to help you navigate the current environment. And that's okay. Like, I think it's just, have your antenna up. Make sure when you're listening to those guys, like, I will say this, I'm always a little bit suspicious when someone's like an Amazon expert, but they like you get a beer with them at the end of the day at a conference and you realize they actually never made any money on Amazon. They just like are really good personal marketers. And so just be aware, like, kind of go in eyes wide open. And, you know, like for me, like, I sold a company with a bunch of employees that doesn't necessarily make me qualified to tell you how to sell your company in this market. Like, I have to be really careful to learn the lessons and then to just actually live where I am now. That's the key. Is Jason and I just want to live in this industry where we are now, so that when we're giving you advice, we're not trying to have you ride on our coattails from 5 years ago or anyone else's.
And thinking of it as to your point, thinking of it as advice, not as law, not as, you know, is that's the other thing. I think, you know, there's a lot of confidence that gets built up in having some success. And when they share their secrets to success, it's shared as like, oh, this will work for every business. And that's just not necessarily, I mean, I've met plenty of CEOs. There's a company here that I used to work with, the SaaS company. They got like 90% margins. They never took on any outside capital. They didn't have to. They just found a interesting niche where they really didn't have to. And I remember him giving some advice to somebody else of like, you should never take outside capital for your business. Like, and it's like, you know, that worked for you. It's like not going to work for 99.999% of businesses. So being able to apply and hear things, which is, I think his point was, don't take outside capital because it gives you the constraint to have good discipline. Good discipline's good. The, like, you know, using it as I had good discipline because I never took out, it's like, that's not necessarily true.
Context is so important. So, well, listen, I want to move towards land in this episode. This has been a great conversation. By the way, you're doing this, Jason, like, you're founding fintech companies and you've got 4 kids. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's pretty busy. I heard somebody's advice earlier this week. I was listening to a podcast. Somebody said, like, don't start a company when you've got kids. I don't know. It's pretty great. It's a good motivator. You got to keep everyone alive and happy, and you know, got to drive towards success. So,
yeah, you know, I didn't know enough to take that advice or not take it. Well, we had a 6-week-old when I burned the boats the first time to start a company, and you're right. It's like the definition of like we're going. This is friends. This is going to work. You know, and it does give you perspective. I mean, do you find time to do stuff that's fun, that's outside of just trying to build this company?
Yeah. I mean, with the kids, obviously that's like, I'm not trying to say this in a bad way, but that's my major hobby, is just hanging out with the kids and doing things. And my sons, I've got 3 boys and 1 girl. My sons love Legos, so we're building Legos quite a bit. We, Yeah, I do say, I will say that, like, I do find myself having to create a lot more boundaries in my schedule than maybe some of my coworkers. There's, you know, 2 hours in the evening I just have to block off. And yeah, if I didn't get up and get my early morning workout, I don't get a workout in that day. I've got to spend the time with the family. So there's some sacrifices for it, but like not in a bad way. It's a great way. And to your point, like it helps you kind of understand why are you doing these things. It's a good reminder of what you're driving to and what you're sacrificing for.
So. I was talking to somebody this morning. It was interesting perspective. Like when my kids are 9 and 11, so we're kind of like fourth grade, sixth grade, life stage we're in, both daughters. And when your kids are small, like your hobby is wiping butts. Like that's what you do. Like it's like if I'm not on a conference call, like somebody's made a mess and my job is to clean it up and to make sure my wife doesn't like implode. Like, and so there's some, right, that's life. And then talking to a gentleman whose kids are going to college now, and one of them being out of college, and then coming back and giving him some counsel. And he's like, Dad, you know, you still have a couple of like my younger siblings at home. And he's like, I just want to remind you, like, would have been great to have you around a little bit more. Like there's some, you know, like make sure, don't forget that your current middle schoolers just want to spend time with you. And so I feel like I love to hear that today, because it kind of shook me back to life this morning to be like, oh, wait a second.
Yeah.
I got to find something creative to relate to a sixth grade girl about constantly. And it's worth every ounce of effort, because, you know, there's only so many years we get to do this. We can go build companies later. So,
yeah, no, that's totally true. I'd say in the fall, usually I watch more football, but I'm an Arizona State grad and we're having some pretty bad years. So, and it doesn't help that Jaden Daniels went to LSU and is having a fantastic season. So I can't really watch any football right now because I can't escape Jaden. But then normally in the fall, it's a lot of football and sports and those types of things.
No, makes sense, man. So, okay. So one, we end each episode with one habit, hack, practice, anything that would be kind of along the lines of giving you an unusual return on investment in your life. Is there something that you do personally or professionally that you're just like, man, try this, guys, you'll love it?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is, you probably get this a lot because I feel like this is every entrepreneur's like outlet in a lot of ways, but I lift a lot of weights. I like lifting weights and lifting heavy. There's something about, I feel like an entrepreneur gets stretched in a lot of different ways emotionally, and you just kind of have to push through. And then putting your body through that same kind of stress every day too somehow kind of connects the mind with the body a little bit. And so exercise, definitely a big part of it, but specifically heavy weights and, getting that kind of, that type of adrenaline.
Awesome, dude. Love it. Now, I mean, something related to exercise is a recurring theme on the show here, but I think that the more I hear from you guys and I'm inspired by you guys as my guest, the more I realize, you know, the higher the intensity that exercise is, the more it can really, you know, not just balance hormones, not just help you with your weight goals, but like give you what you need mentally to kind of get through the stress of these days.
It's definitely a mental outlet. Yeah. It's fantastic. And I, you know, just maybe a plug on that. You don't need a lot of equipment. You don't need a lot of anything. It's to your point. It's the intensity. If you can get that intensity up, it's important. You know, it doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be anything, but connecting that mind to body, I think, is a good thing.
Awesome. Well, guys, for those of you again who've made it 45 minutes into this show, we just appreciate it. Thank you for spending time with me and Jason today. Jason, I'm going to make sure that anyone who's listened to this has access to your links. In fact, I may even get you to send me that link to your personal blog, because that was a little bit hard to catch here when we were talking about it. But just to kind of clarify a little bit, holdings.io. The person who needs to contact you immediately, I'm not saying contact Jason, but the person that needs to sign up with holdings.io is feeling what? Like what? Give us as clear a picture as possible what that guy felt yesterday that should make them pull the trigger.
Yeah, I'd say if you've built some cash up in your cash reserves and you've got, you know, you got it sitting there for a period of time, even a month, and you want to do something more with that, that's us. That's where we help you access strategies to manage your cash better. And you know, just to maybe reiterate, like every $1 million put in there is for, you know, 4,000 a month. So 4.82% is what we pay out. You're never paying fees unless you get interest checks. So an interest check gets dropped into your bank account once a month. We take the fee out of that. And we take a small percentage of what you make. And then it is, you know, FDIC insured up to 3 million. So especially if you've got more than 250K in your bank account, you're exposed to your bank risk. If that bank fails, you're going to lose that money over 250K. So we can get it up to 3 million. You can stack that. So if you've got 250K in your normal bank, you put 3 million with us, you've got 3.25 million in FDIC. And then maybe the last thing to emphasize is we are completely liquid. It is same day transfers. If you're worried about getting tied up, you've looked at CDs and you just can't do that. That's what we're built for. You can get your money back to your main bank or to anywhere else same day through wires or 24 business hours through ACH.
Beautiful. Love it. Jason Garcia, CEO, holdings.io. Jason, thanks again for joining ROP today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, guys. Thanks again for joining the show. Until we see you next week, just hope you kill it. Have a great week. Till then, bye.